Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft.
Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. English 115F, Fall 2007, Vanderbilt University. Professor Jay Clayton, Professor Matthew Jed Hall. Visit our class blog at worldsofwordcraft.wordpress.com.
Let's start off reintroducing people because I don't think I remember anybody's name. It's going to take me a while. Are we recording right now?
You're live, but I will edit it out. I will edit it out. However, cell phones on stun, guys. If you got them, mute them.
On stun. Exactly. So I've got a sign-up sheet going around. I would like the name of your main character and what class, whether it's a lore master, a guardian, watch out for the wire. If you're going to pull that chair, you're going to have to pull one chair up and we'll maybe move this away and scrunch in or something. Don't park there. Don't sit at that end because I'm going to be walking to the board that way. So take it down to the other end, will you please?
Yeah.
Thanks. The sign-up sheet, has it gone all the way around? Everybody gotten on there?
There's like three people.
We're going to try and accomplish several things here. First of all, Matt's going to talk about a few procedures, run through things with you a little bit further, and then we're going to talk about gamer theory, and then we're going to end with the Jesper Jewell reading. Did anyone not read these two today?
I didn't understand it. I didn't understand it. I read it, but I didn't really get it.
Well, that's why we're going to have this class. You're going to understand it at the end of this class. Absolutely. Yes.
Were we supposed to read the thing above it? / I didn't really know where to find that. There was two readings for me.
There was one. It was a link on Facebook.
I posted
it. And, okay, it also said, so you didn't read Jesper Jewell. Is that what you're saying?
Right.
Okay. First of all, thanks to, was it you, Wesley, that posted it?
No, it was Michael.
Michael? Thanks to Michael. It was posted on our Facebook page. But as you see, Professor Hall's got right up there our syllabus. Everything that says Central Library Reserve means you go to the Central Library, that's, her library. You ask at the main desk for the reserve. They're going to ask you which class. You say Clayton and Hall. Or you say English 115, section 18, I believe, and you get your reading. So how many did not get the Jesper Jewell read? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Vanderbilt students failed to do the reading. That's for our...
Honor code, they're being honest.
Right, of course they are. Oh, I didn't. It never even occurred to me that they wouldn't tell the truth. But I want our listening audience to hear. Did everyone get Gamer Theory read? Excellent. So we'll spend most of our time on Gamer Theory. You are responsible for reading it. Track it down. A lot of things are going to be at the library as opposed to online. So you need to get used to using Central Library. Matt.
We're talking about the blogs.
Yes, I think that'd be great.
And then we never did look up what our topic was.
No, we didn't.
And I'll pop that up during the course and we'll talk about it. All right, guys, I've only received 4 requests for our blog to associate with the blog. It's Worlds of WordCraft. Get over here so you can show you.
Who's that?
Check out the URL. Type it in, bear with me a moment. worldsofwordcraft.wordpress.com. Let's discuss what we're going to do with this. Every week we're going to have either an open-ended entry requirement that just could be an expansive topic that you select, or Professor Clayton and I will be giving a particular topic which we'll be assigning today. you've got to get an account, as we mentioned on the first day of class, at WordPress.com. Get yourself set up. If you don't have it, it's a very simple process. It's in the FAQ, oak.vanderbilt.edu, under course information and syllabus. There's instructions on how to set up an account. www.wordpress.com, set up your account. Then we'll make you, you'll just send me an email with your email address that you use when you signed up for the account, and I will add you into the blog, and you'll be able to publish to this. Now, the assignment that we're going to give, we do know this much. You've all been asked to get yourselves out of our chat. We're going to ask that you take a picture, a screenshot of yourself somewhere in the Lord of the Rings online universe, and post that to the blog with some accompanying text that I'll tell you the assignment a little bit later in class. That'll be your first blog entry for this week. There's a good tool that I want to bring to your attention that makes writing the blogs a little bit easier. There's an online editor for this that you can use in the context of the website. However, there's a great tool for Windows. I think it may go over for you Mac users, but I'm not sure. At least you could use it in boot camp. Blogdesk.org. This is a word processor where you can essentially type in your blog post, add a screenshot, and then you can size and crop the screenshot there to your satisfaction inside that tool. It just makes things a little bit easier to work with. So check out blogdesk.org. It's a free tool. It's very good. I've been using it for about 2 years now, and I think it's a really wonderful tool to interact with WordPress. And I'll get you the topic for our blog entry. Do you want to talk about our weekly blog requirements now? A little bit, Jay?
So we are going to ask you to write in the blog every week. So as we talked about in our first class period, that involves saying something that is on your mind about one of the readings, about some aspect of game experience, some social interaction you've had inside the game. It can be relatively informal writing, but it is a big part of your grade, so we're going to be reading it and paying attention to it.
30% of the grade.
Yes, and so what we want to see is that you're engaged, you're putting some effort into it. You're not writing formal essays. You don't have to just, you don't have to have a well-structured, well-formulated essay each week. But you do have to have thought about something and written about it in an engaging way so that we can tell that you care about the topic and that you've made us care about it. And that can, as I say, be fairly informal, but not really slangy and not a lot of internet abbreviations and smiley faces and the like. And feel free to comment on one another's entries. It would be very nice to have this blog turn into a real discussion board. Remember that it's going to be out there in the world. We may be getting comments from people all around the world on your blog.
Yeah, may I add something to this?
Yes.
There's an interesting phenomena when you're posting on the web. When you have a MySpace, a Facebook, and a blog, be very thoughtful about your screen names that you choose. I've seen a couple interesting ones come in. We're not here to censor you. This is America. You're free to do what you want. The other side of freedom is with great freedom comes great responsibility and great consequences. If you choose provocative or otherwise inflammatory screen names, and I know this because I've done this before, you will bear some consequence. Your reputation may be impacted. You may have a bad experience or get banned from a game as a result of it, or get banned from a blog. So think about what screen names you choose and what you choose to disclose. You would not put nude photos of yourself out on the trees throughout campus. Don't do strange posts or things that you don't want to get mass exposure to the outside world. Just be very circumspect in what you do, and be very thoughtful about how you represent yourself in the cyber world, because that does come and bleeds, as we'll discuss in the gamer theory in a few moments, into the real world.
Very true. Speaking of the real world, this is out of sequence, but I thought I'd check my mail by right-clicking on that mailbox in-game, and I got a letter from somebody I know in-game giving me a very valuable item, an immensely valuable item, just to be nice. I got another letter saying, good morning, I don't know what that's all about. And then I got a spam to sell me gold for real world cash. Those of you all that have played games before know that there are gold farmers trying to sell you gold, which in-game gold, for actual money. People have different opinions about this. I strongly object to people buying real life, buying gold with real life money, because I think it inflates the economy of the game. You know, if you get, you know, all this gold for, you know, $10, which is pretty cheap right now because they want to get a build up their clientele, then prices in the game's economy go skyrocketing, and it also prevents you from having the experience of making that money for yourself. Now, not everyone shares this view. In fact, my co-teacher doesn't always agree with me on this. He's a capitalist. What can he say? Is it Jonathan?
I buy gold also.
Is it Jonathan?
Yeah.
Okay, Jonathan. Yes.
I buy gold on loan, so like a bit sometimes.
Okay.
When I'm in deep need of it.
Right. Don't do it in this game for the life of this class. As soon as the class is over, run wild.
You wonder why Jonathan's all pimped out and you're not? Find out soon enough.
Okay. So that I'm very happy that message came up so that we could have that little bit of discussion. On your blog, Professor Hall has just mentioned he wants you to post a screenshot of your character standing or somewhere outside of our chat. Does everyone know how to do a screenshot?
Control N.
Print screen.
I think also maybe Control 12 here, and it'll download it with a onto your hard drive. You're going to want to change the name of that file and then upload it back up.
It should be under your My Documents, Lord of the Rings. Is where the file should be.
Right.
And then you can hit F12 to relieve yourself of all the extraneous controls.
What?
Well, I'll be on my boot camp audition, but I still have this keyboard.
Right.
So, figure that out.
Experiment.
Okay.
And as soon as you find it, post it to Facebook for your fellow Mac users, how to take a screenshot.
In boot camp, they tell you the keyboard. Like what keys correspond to which PC keys.
Any questions about that?
I have a question about the blog.
Absolutely.
Is there a certain way we're supposed to set up our blog to affiliated with this class, or do we just make one?
Send me an email. You're going to be posting. I'm glad you asked a clarifying question, Wesley. You will be posting to the Worlds of WordCraft. Send matt.hall@vanderbilt.edu the message. Here's my email address that you used when you set up your, like McLovin here did, set up his WordPress account. Then I'll add him in, and he'll be able to post to the Worlds of WordCraft class blog. So worldsofwordcraft.wordpress.com is where you're going to post your work. So we're going to see if we should see 15 blog entries from each of you.
So by the time
the assignment comes due.
So I didn't need to make my own at work.
But you're welcome to it.
Yes.
And we'll put you on our blog roll, and we can read your private blog as well as your class contributions to the class blog. Okay? Or you can delete your blog.
I might do that.
Right.
I've never blogged before. This is a new experience.
Okay.
New to us, too, so we'll see how it works out.
Other questions about the blog? Okay, well, let's talk about our reading for the day. Is that a question?
No.
Let's talk about the reading for the day. We read Gamer Theory in an online version so that you didn't have to Xerox it or buy a copy of it. This is a book by Mackenzie Wark, who's an associate professor of cultural and media studies at the New School for Social Research in New York, New York City. It's a very prestigious university that he works for, and his professional field is media studies, and of course he thinks that online games are an aspect not only of our culture at large, but of media studies. So let me just first of all ask, I mean, you see up there the version 2.0 with all the comments that people have made, and I believe you too could make comments as you read it for people to, for him to respond to, for that matter. There was an earlier version, 1.1, and I read it in 1.1 initially, and then Harvard University Press published a hardbound copy of the book in, you know, paper form, so that it doesn't have all these features, but it does include the comments, or at least the best of the comments from 1.1 as footnotes to it. And you really get a different sense reading it in a book from reading it online. It was clearly conceived as an online book rather than a hardbound book. We're going to talk about four topics here today that arise out of our reading of this chapter one of his book. First, let me just ask what you thought of the reading experience. Anybody have just a reaction to the reading experience? Somebody last night in the game said they thought it was cool. You don't have to make that confession.
No, I shared it with all my friends. I texted and all my friends that are gamers, and I told them to read it because I knew they'd appreciate it. And it's merits. It really did have some really good points.
What about other reactions? We want to foster good discussion. We don't want a lot of silence going out over the radio waves here, out over the internet. So this is an opportunity with no risk whatsoever to just say what you thought about it, about the experience of reading it. How did you like clicking on it? How did you like that bright yellow background? Yes, Greg.
Well, I appreciated the ideas that he discussed, and I liked a lot of what he talked about, but I thought that a lot of the time he was talking around things, and he uses a lot of, like, you know, circular thinking that ends up going on to tangents that kind of get wordy and hard to read. So
the style got in the way somewhat for you, too.
Yeah.
I think that's fair to say for many of you. Great majority are economics majors, not used to this high academic literary theory talk that he uses. Say your name.
Chris,
yes.
I think the style was kind of went with where he published it. Like, I think he intentionally kind of went off on like a tangent because he wanted to just be like the gamer theory is just some book he wrote on the internet. And I think it was to add to the actual content of the book.
So that the style fits the function, that,
right.
The form there. You know, it's published in little snippets, sort of paragraph-long sections. So it does make it very easy to be digressive, to have poor transitions, to take logical leaps, to do things to show off, as opposed to making a consistent argument. You get that a lot in hypertext writing, and this is a form, it's a pretty straightforward form of hypertext. There's not a lot of links. Nonetheless, you could read it in any order. You don't have to read it consecutively. Other reactions to it? Yes.
Kind of like what you were just saying, I enjoyed that it wasn't like you had to read it all at once and, you know, get it together. It's kind of nice that you could read it in snippets, as you were saying. Okay.
I think you had your... Everybody say their name first.
I'm Seth. And I enjoyed reading about the Parable of the Cave again. It's one of my favorite things about English. I saw Plato and the Philosopher's King and all that stuff. That was kind of interesting how he used video games and that kind of concept. But then he talks about how being outside is just another video game. Kind of like the endless series of games within games within games.
Do you think that's true?
The whole Plato's the cave?
No.
The whole world's a game?
The whole world's a game.
Sometimes it seems that way.
I think you had your hand up first, Matt.
Yeah, Matt. I thought when it was written like that so informally, it kind of took away from the seriousness of the topic. I mean, obviously, we're trying to legitimize ourselves as a real form of media. So if we're kind of writing this trite, this kind of happy-go-lucky, it doesn't seem all that serious in my respect. So it's kind of just buttressing their ideas that they're gamers.
Right.
So that's the only problem I had with it.
Interesting idea. So you preferred the style of a book of Jesper Juul, for example?
Yes, that's
okay.
The one I like.
I think Jonathan had his hand up first.
Oh, yes. I'm Jonathan. And the whole time I was reading, I kept thinking, like, this is so similar to The Matrix. Like, and they also had, like, an analogy. They talked about the blue pill and the red pill.
Yeah, that's right.
That was a direct, like, example from The Matrix. But also the whole overall idea was very similar.
Right. And doesn't that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm pretty sure that he had something like that in mind. He wouldn't have, I mean, of course you pointed out he used red pill, blue pill from the movie The Matrix, but you know, The Matrix, the whole notion of that movie is that the world is one vast simulacrum of that's all exists in a digital space, not in a so-called material space. Chris, you had your hand up on a different point. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. I forgot.
Forgot it. Other reactions here. So,
isn't it drawing inspiration from Plato?
Indeed. That's so. What about Plato?
Well, I remember I read last year the Allegory of the Cave, and it was saying a fairly similar thing, at least for part of it.
Yep, it's sort of lexia. You could call these little snippets lexia. That's the word people use for hypertext. Lexia, and it just means a single unit of writing on the internet, regardless of its length. So Alexia can be one word or it can be 10 pages. So I think it's Alexia 2 through 5 are about the cave. You want to comment on it?
Well, not Alexia.
No, the cave.
Well, I was going to comment on how, like in 10th grade, I had a really cool English teacher. We watched The Matrix while we studied Plato as the cave.
Uh-huh.
And there's so many direct links. Like, you know, when Neo comes out, it's really bright and light. That's like direct reference to when you come out of the cave, it's really bright, you can't see images clearly, and how like Morpheus and Neo are both philosopher kings, and how they try to come back into the Matrix to free everybody. It's all a big circle, and I liked how he worked with that stuff. Yeah, the title is Agony of the Cave, and so he used all the different media to, like from the film, which would be the Matrix, and then literature played it. So he used all that about game.
Right. So he put gaming into a continuum with books prior to the invention of the printing press books, in fact, Plato's The Cave, to movies, to the internet, and the gaming world. Why is it called Agony? Why is this title called Agony?
Well, I think that it describes a vicious cycle where each, you know, the game within a game within a game, and where also Harry describes how life in turn becomes a game, and then your games become how serious and work as the game of your life has become. And I think that cycle is agonizing in that it's inescapable, at least within his, you know, ideas.
Absolutely. Jonathan.
Could it relate to the fact that agon means competition?
I bet it could. Did you hear that? That agon means competition. And that's a great point, that all of these games are structured as competitions, as conflicts. How are games conflicts? I mean, it's not just that your character has to go out and fight. It's that he talks about the whole game being made out of binary decisions. Them, us, on, off, zero, one. So that the digital world itself could be thought of as a kind of instantiating a dualistic or binary universe.
Is the score the thing? At the end of the day, they talked about the level playing field, right? How much does the score matter in the game and in the real world?
How many of you all have not read Plato's Allegory of the Cave? Okay. So several people haven't. So why don't we just lay that out for the group, the Allegory of the Cave.
Can we get a drawing on the air?
Pardon me?
Can we draw on the screen?
Sure. Do you know how to?
I'm not sure.
First of all, you don't trip over his car.
Oh, I could just draw on it.
No, we want it up here because we're going to make this available afterwards.
So what's a good drawing space here? Class notes, is that the note?
That's where we want to be.
Okay. So then we want to get
a new page.
Would that be it?
Student file.
New, very top.
Insert, and then eventually you'll hit get blank page. There you go.
Got it. Okay. So pick your color, black, blue, red, or green. Pick it up and draw Plato's K for us.
I don't remember the actual objects. Can I just make my own?
Make them, indeed.
So basically the way that the cave is set up is these people are in a giant cave. Is this my eraser?
Yes.
Yes.
That's cool. These people are in a cave.
Set your eraser back down.
And there's light coming in through the cave, but there's some sort of wall set up, and they're chained to the wall, chained to the wall, and cannot see over the wall, and cannot see out of the cave or anything like that. All this person can see is this wall over here. And what happens is there's a fire set up at the beginning, or somewhere in the cave, this fire is casting a shadow from something in between the fire and the wall. Let's say like a little butterfly. Yeah, a little butterfly here. And this person cannot see the butterfly, and or they could actually just use the light, which is casting the shadow on the butterfly. But the butterfly's shadow is cast upon this opposite wall. And so let's say this person, instead of seeing this harmless little butterfly, sees some giant fire-breathing dragon. You know, he sees this thing, and he's scared, of course, of the Godzilla-like creature.
Christmas tree.
That's basically it. He doesn't see the outside world.
Bravo! This is an art history class, after all.
Awesome job.
That's me. Into a bonnet.
Probably should remove.
This is probably the most
sophisticated.
Yes, the most famous passage in all of Plato. It's from his book about the ideal state called The Republic. And the point that Plato's trying to illustrate by this allegory is it's an allegory of life. And he says, what if all we think we're living in the real world, but in fact we're living in a world in which all we can see are the shadows cast upon the wall. And we have no idea. I mean, we believe there are originals, but we have no access to the originals. We only have the shadows. So work uses that as analogy for gaming. How is that like gaming? How is being in Plato's cave like being in gaming?
Because we see shadows of the people as their avatars.
There he is. Whoa, he turned around to look at me, right as I said it.
On cue.
Yes. Yes. Okay, that's certainly true. That's a big way. It's like that. How else otherwise? This cave wall is like a screen, isn't it? Yeah,
sometimes sometimes gamers might get stuck in their own cave and they don't venture out into the real world enough.
Exactly.
Well, sometimes I think whenever you're in a game, you often don't represent yourself as you truly are. And so you just see a shadow and you don't see the true representation of that person. I mean, whether it be gender, whether it be personality, sometimes people change completely when they're in the game.
And that gives you a lot of freedom to do that. Mm-hmm. It can be exhilarating to change completely. How many people created a female avatar? Two out of 15.
It was my hall. Please don't blame
me. Yes.
I,
was going to say that the game itself and the difference between the game and the real world, you couldn't tell the difference if you were a gamer. It could get to the point where you would never know.
And that's part of Work's point, isn't it? Now, Work's point is not merely that you couldn't tell the difference between the game and the real world in a psychotic sense. You know, we've read that in newspapers, you know, almost from the day they invented video games, was the vision that, oh, we're going to get so obsessed with this imaginary world, we're going to live in our own digital world, and we're going to turn into fat slobs. I want to point out for our listening audience, there is not a single unfit person in this room right now. This is a very fit group of gamers.
Especially the professors.
Especially the professors. But, you know, the youth of the world today are going to do nothing but sit in a darkened room playing in a virtual world and not getting out and climbing trees and playing sports. So there's that sense. Is there another sense in which Work wants you to think about the cave as an analogy for gaming? Not yet? Yes.
Well, I sort of see a connection to the fact that he's constantly making passes at the real world being a game. So, I mean, that goes back to the cave directly because Plato isn't talking about games. Plato is talking about the real world, and so is he. He's sort of saying that, I mean, because he's sort of restating Plato's sort of hypothesis, saying the stock market, the economy, the, political races, war even, everything isn't about what we say it's about. It's just about winning.
That's really well said. That Work is maintaining that the world outside the game is structured like the game, is a game, that in fact the digital games we play are in some ways allegories of the game that is life in a postmodern contemporary world. You know, he says that most vividly in page 6 of the chapter. Do some of you all have it up on your computer? You can read it there. Or I wanted to use our board here.
Set your pen down.
I gotta set my pen down. Thank you. Here we are. These are quotes from page 6. So if you have it on your computer, pull it up and let your neighbor look at it so you can get the entire context. Then here we'll work with these little fragments that I have you know, what we really could do is project it up instead of cheerable there onto the board there too. So we could have the passage we're discussing in multiple frameworks.
Can you do that?
Want to go? Yeah. We'll wait for Matt. He'll do it. Let's talk about this passage here. The whole of life appears as a vast accumulation of commodities and spectacles, of things wrapped in images and images sold as things. But talk about that for a second. I mean, the whole of life appears as a vast accumulation of commodities and spectacles. How is that like a game? First of all, does that seem true to you, or does that seem overly cynical? You say no, it doesn't seem right to you.
That seems like a very pessimistic view of the world, that everything is very commercialized, basically. That's kind of what he's saying. Everything is just a product.
Yeah. Leslie?
It's also very, I just lost my word. Exclusive. It seems like he's oversimplified. The entire thing did seem very oversimplified to me. There are always exceptions. There are always, breaks the rule. And of course, whenever you're making a generalized theory like this, it's impossible to take in all the exceptions, but it just seemed a little bit of a stretch.
Matt Cope?
For like the things wrapped in images, just look at how we dress. Most people in here, we know it's you have a shirt with the logo on it. You buy it the way you buy clothes. It's not so much you buy, like, you know, the Abercrombie and Hollister. It's very popular, not so much because it's well made, because of the name. You're buying the brand. You're not necessarily buying the clothes. You want the brand.
Feel free to talk to one another, to comment. As we get to know one another better, it's going to be great when we can have a discussion where I don't have to say, yes, good comment. Who would like to comment on what Michael just said, but rather you just react to him. So, you know, he just accused you of being walking billboards for various clothing companies. You want to defend yourself? Do you believe? Do you agree with him?
I think he's probably. I mean, for the most part, I think that comment that's right there is pretty. It's generalized, but it's a good generalization. I think it accurately depicts some of the things that go on in the world.
Excellent. Yes, sir.
Well, I think one thing that sort of agrees with what Michael said. A lot of things that we wear and display are, you know, I don't know what else, I want to say badges, or, you know, they display some sort of an act or a deed or something that you're proud of. Like, people go through great lengths, I don't know if you have tabards in Lotro, but, you know, they're epic tabards, and they're stuff that you have to buy, like, in World of Warcraft, and, you know, they don't add anything to your statistics, but it's something that you wear with pride because it took a lot of effort to gain. And or even a shirt that says I volunteered for something or something that you're proud of, it can be like that. It doesn't have to be negative. It doesn't have to be, you know, not that I think wearing Abercrombie is negative, but some people might take it that way. But I just think it's the generalization can be taken towards many different levels.
Yes.
I think the pride goes in with the competition too, though, because, like, I mean, the Hollister thing is sort of like a pride of brand, but I mean, all my shirts actually, I don't know why this happens, but all my shirts come from, like, science museum gift shops, not just science museums, but, like, gift shops, or I'll be at, like, a sports event, and there will be, like, a shirt for that sports event or whatever. But I mean, as you said, it's sort of a pride and things. But if you have, when you said the volunteer shirt, I was just wondering, you know, you're wearing a volunteer shirt. Is that because you're happy you volunteered, or is that because you want everyone else to know that you volunteered? Like, this shirt doesn't make a lick of sense. It says, green leaf, peace leaf, all the leaves have fall from the tree. Leafy leafless, groundless rumor proverb says. That's because it's from Japan. Now, I think it's funny, and my brother brought it home for me from Japan. But that also leads into a lot of stories where if someone's like, that sure doesn't make any sense, then I say, well, you know, it's from Japan. Oh, yes, I went this summer, and I was there for 2 weeks, and blah, 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 blah. I mean, I don't know, you know, if I wear it for that purpose, but I guess that's certainly a sort of a perk, a conversation starter, or it could go into competition. I mean, I think he has an overly cynical view of the world, but you can see how everything can sort of fill into his theory, I think.
What does he mean by commodities and spectacles? Commodities, we understand. Spectacles of things wrapped in images and images sold as things.
Yes. Sights and observations. So.
Say more. That was a little cryptic for me. Sights and observations.
Like spectacles, like observing these images.
That's right.
And like,
so how do you sell images as things?
Video games.
Advertisement, video games.
Marketing.
Like name. Paintings. Like a name brand for anything.
That's right.
That's
you wanted to say more? Still in Vexia 6, you observe that world after world, cave after cave, what prevails is the same agon, the same digital logic. Of one versus the other, digital logic of one versus the other, ending in victory or defeat. Agony rules. So whoever explicated agony for us in the first place did a great job right at the beginning of class at the chapter Agony Rules, because agon rules. Everything.
Does Jonathan get experience points for doing that?
Yes, he gets XP for that. Everything has value only when ranked against another. Everyone has value only when ranked against another. every situation is win-lose. Too cynical for you? It's certainly true in the game world, isn't it? Is that a critique of the game world? Or just a statement of how things are? Matt, yeah?
Well, I think part of why games exist is because in life so much of stuff is gray. So when you want to escape life, so you go play video games, it's nice to have something that's black and white, win-lose. So I mean, if you lose, that sucks. But if you win, yeah. Kind of why you're trying to escape.
It's fair, no matter what. It's fair.
Right.
Right. That's...
Do you really believe that the game world that he describes here is fair?
Well, apparently not. People are selling gold.
So Matt is clinging to a distinction between games and life. He's saying we like games because they're simplified, because they're win-lose, because it's an either-or choice. I'm sorry, I can't remember.
Daniel,
thank you, Daniel.
He said that the world is like an imperfect game, and how that when you're in a game, everything is a level playing field, or at least when you start, it's a level playing field, so people play it because it's fair. But in life, it's like an imperfect game. It's supposed to be fair, but there's gray. I mean, there's certain situations where life isn't fair.
There's a lot of situations where life isn't fair. Other comments on that? What does it mean, the digital logic? Maybe it's an obvious point to you, so obvious that it's... that you don't know what I'm asking for, but spell it out. What does it mean, the digital logic? Yes.
Pros and cons, zeros and ones, like the computer reads in the input and decides the best outcome.
Right.
There.
Right. Digital universe is just an on-off switches, ones and zeros. So that binary code that is at the, you know, is at the core of the video games we're playing, Work is making the point that it's not merely at the core of the games we're playing, but as a metaphor or an allegory is for a larger situation in our world, which is that there's a winner and there's a loser in everything we do. Yes, Wesley.
Well, I think that really makes me think of one of the big ideas around, you know, the movie iRobot, where the digital logic and how, you know, digitally there was one right choice and one wrong choice, but you know, in our train of logic, which I believe is superior, there is an actual better choice, such as whenever the incident where the main character was in a car wreck and the child wasn't saved, he was saved. It was, I think that's also that really makes me think of.
Yeah.
The digital logic is cold, heartless, and it's blind.
Playing by the numbers.
Very strong. I want to move now to section 15. Turn over to section 15 of the book. Still talking about how the world is like a video game, in Bart's opinion. And this section begins with a very interesting sentence. So this is the world as it appears to the gamer, a matrix of endlessly varying games, a game space, all reducible to the same principles, all producing the same kind of subject who belongs to this game space in the same way as a gamer to a game. All producing the same kind of subject. Yes.
All, like, everyone who plays the game is making their character, and as they play through the game, they're leveling him up, and, like, because the set of game rules, because I read the Jewel, Jesper Jewel, and he talks about progressive video games versus, I forget the name for the other ones.
Emergent.
Yeah, there you go.
Emergence and progression. Excellent.
And the progression games are most depicting of this, because there's a set of rules that you have to follow in order to get your character where he needs to be to the next level. And also, all these people are leveling their characters, they're progressing through this game, so.
definitely not. And yeah, and Jesper Jewell's thing also, the I thought he was a little harsh on the emergence and what's the other one?
Progressive
game, because where you're trying to level, I think it's also a huge social tool. And he was, you know, he kind of criticized how the story gets lost, but it's also really based on the player-to-player interaction.
So both of these comments, which are both excellent comments, are about how the game produces a subject inside the game. How about the way it molds you outside of the game? Because I think that's what Warwick is actually driving at. Now, producing a subject is actually a little bit of a philosophical jargon. Subject means self. You might use the equivalent term might be the self. So all reducible to the same principles, all producing the same kind of self or human being. His point, which you all have really explicated quite well, is that, you know, those games do train you to want to be level 50, to want to have these various uber aspects of your character, and it talks you into, or it produces this desire in you for the same kind of thing. You know, you can't desire outside of its system, at least not very easily. Not in play and succeed at the game. So that's how it's shaping you inside the game. And those of you that have played a lot of games might have grown tired of the routine, because most of the games have pretty much the same structure. You learn to play your character, you level him up. Once you've got him or her high enough, you do a lot of PvP, combat against other players, and then you move on to another game, which is very convenient for the commercial industry, because you're buying more product continuously. How about the way it produces you as a subject outside of the game? Now, let me ask, anyone that hasn't spoken so far today, start thinking of what your next comment's going to be, so that everybody participates and gets into the flow of things. So I'm not going to say, answer my question right now, but just start thinking about what you're going to say to be part of the discussion. Yes?
I think as like you play these games and you progress your character, these people who are playing these games like so regularly, they think like, you know, well, if I'm doing these tasks to level my character, I'm guaranteed to get this level. So as I build experience, my character is going to get better. So they think in the real life, well, like, hey, if I do my homework, then I'm going to get better. Or like, it's sort of like active versus passive learning. Actually, in my chemistry syllabus, they tell you about being an active learner instead of a passive learner. So like, if you're being passive, it's just doing the homework assignment and getting it done and saying, oh, well, that means I learned the stuff. But actively, you know, you're actually not really learning it unless you're asking yourself questions, asking the teacher questions. So like, the gamer is sort of like, you know, a passive way to approach the world.
It's super. For the internet audience, I'm nodding my appreciation.
It's kind of funny because my dad just talked to say, you've gained way too much. You think it's okay to fail. You know, you're only studying because you always think you have another chance. There's always another life. There's always another quarter you can put in the machine. And that's your generation's fault, is that sometimes there isn't a perfect second chance, or you'll never get another chance to take the ACT or the SAT. So it's kind of funny, the contrasting viewpoints on that.
That's right. What would Jesper Jewell say to your father on that exact point? You recall Jesper Jewell's point about just because a game does something in the fiction of the game doesn't mean that the people playing the game endorse or adopt or imitate that method of behaving. Yes.
I think it's almost the exact opposite of that being true, in that people realize that they have stuff to do in real life and they like to get that done, and they go into the game to kind of escape from it a little bit, and they're like, oh, this is really fun, but I know I'm just going to go back to doing what do I have to do in real life, it's a job or school or whatever, and the game's just like a source of relaxation, something to keep you going in the real life.
Now, what's radical about Warwick is he doesn't want you to think to adopt that posture either, because that posture is premised on there being a radical separation between games and real life. And if our world is structured as a game of commodities and spectacles, is there that radical distinction? I mean, we all believe it on some level. That's how we live. Oh, it's just a game. So think about that. Think what you'd say back to work on that. Do you have a comment, Michael?
Well, I mean, like a lot of people do think that, you know, most of the people that think games are a game, you know, they play them for an hour or two, and they're done, and that's it. But I guess one of the reasons games are being so vilified in the media is because of the few people that don't. The few people that make it a life, that they make it their real life. I mean, you hear, you know, every few weeks about another person who plays for 3 days straight and dies because they didn't drink any water.
Yes.
It's kind of on the whole escaping the real world type things. A lot of things in video games, at least one of the draws for me that I can't do in real life, when I go on a video game, I can do these things. Like, you know, with this game, it's one of my first times playing a game of this nature, just throwing that out there. So I get to, like, follow the whole story and, like, you know, level my guy up. It's, like, something I obviously can never do in real life. Like, with sports games, which I'm big into, like, play, like, FIFA, I'm not good at soccer. I can't play soccer, but it's kind of cool to be able to, you know, start with a soccer video game and just sit down and do that for a while. So I kind of like that kind of an escape, but kind of the draw that you can do things that you can't do in the real world.
Are you about to make a comment?
This is Matt. I just wanted to say one thing. Aren't you leveling up in life when you're starting as a freshman? What's your next level?
Sophomore.
Yeah. If you're in martial arts, you're white belt, then you're yellow belt. If you're a soccer player, don't you accumulate experience, like the number of times you've kicked the goal? Aren't there stats for ball players?
I was going to say that when you're in a game, it's easy to see how you're going to get to the next level. Like, you say, okay, I'm going to sit here for X number of minutes. I'm going to kill these many animals. I'm going to go on these quests. My XP is going to go up, and I'm going to get to a new level. But in life, it's like you can't really see how you're going to get from a college student to a dad making money, supporting a family. There's no like, oh, if I just go to work, if I just do this, it'll just happen. You have to actively like pursue it, and it's kind of unknown how you're gonna get there.
All right. Yes. Say your name.
It's Will. I just think this whole idea of of life being like a matrix of different games is such a cynical point of view, and saying like how there are rules in games, okay, but there really aren't any rules to life. You can live your life however you really want to live it, and in a game there's only so much you can actually do, that there's no way you can compare real life in a game. There's so many limits to a game in the video game world opposed to the game of life, I guess.
I mean, there are, like, limit. I mean, there are rules to life. I mean, there are laws. So it's just a different way of, you know, games, instead of you can't break the rules.
But unlike
where in life you can break them, yeah, but there are consequences to
break
them.
But choose to break them.
But there's code. There's, like,
yeah,
things that you physically cannot do. You can break the law if that's what you want to do.
Or you can
game,
hack
you can.
The game.
I mean, you can. Okay. Well,
that's like just like breaking the law.
No, because that'd be like changing the fundamental existence of life, basically. If you're going to hack the game, that'd be starting over. That's playing God.
But the law is part of the game. Like, if you break the law, you're choosing to pay the fine for the, you know, efficiency of walking across the street before getting to the crosswalk sort of thing. I mean, I think Warwick might be right in that you can categorize any amount of life into a game. I mean, some games have variable rules. Depending on where you are, the rules change. But I think what Warwick is missing is that he says games are about
competition, and that games are about winning and about leveling up and increasing statistics. And I think while that may be true, I think the reason that evolved is because people have fun when they compete. And I think he's missing that sort of at the heart of games is the idea that you're supposed to have fun. And some people, I mean, some people like get into a game and they're not having fun anymore, they just need to play. Like when you're playing poker and you lost all your money, and you just buy back in, so you try to get your money back, and you're just angry at everyone because you lost your money. I don't know if that's happened to anyone. It's happened to me like once. But, yeah, that sort of thing. But, I mean, a lot of times you play games because they're fun. So, I mean, even if life is a bunch of games, can it be a bunch of fun games? I mean, however you categorize it. I don't know. I think he's taking it very cynical. Life is a game, so it's not fun because games aren't fun. Games are about agony and building character.
Leslie.
Well, it occurs to me that he takes all these similarities between games and real life, and he acts like, you know, he says real life is a game, but games were designed by people in real life, and they're invariably imprinted with, you know, with our joys, our fears, with our economy, with our competition, and that's, I mean, a game is a created thing that reflects the real life, so of course it's going to reflect real life. I don't see how you can bring it back around whenever it's like saying the mirror is reality.
It's like saying the shadows on Plato's wall.
That's right.
Well, yes, go ahead.
I was going to also add that we use the word game, but it's becoming more just like a simulated world, really, instead of a game. When I think of game, I think of something like FIFA, or a sports game. I think there's a difference between a sports video game and then like what I would call a simulated world, right? A role-playing game.
Well, you know, that's a point Jesper Juul makes really well.
Yeah, progression.
Progression and emergence games. He says a game like tennis, a rule. He's asking the question, are games a set of rules or are games fictions? And he wants to answer ultimately both. But you can certainly analyze some games at one end of that continuum as being more like just a set of rules, and those he calls games of emergence because they give you a finite set of rules, very small set of rules, yet myriad forms of gameplay arise within those rules. Chess is a good example, tennis, most sports are those kinds of games. Whereas he says, games that are based on fictions are more like progressions, and where you move through the fiction partly in order just to experience the storyline.
And they also mentioned that the game designer has all the power. He gets to control what the gamer does and what he has the ability to do.
Jonathan makes a good point there. Does that seem paradoxical to you? That a game that is made out of a really vibrant fictional world like Lord of the Rings might actually be more under control of the game designer, the author of the game, than a game that's actually quite rigid and abstract and has just a few sets of rules like chess. Is that a paradox? Does that seem paradoxical to you? Does that seem true? Well, think about that.
Could you say that again, please?
Yes, I certainly can. A game that is based on a fiction, that has a real storyline, which is in many ways much more vibrant and alive because you've got all those imagined characters that Tolkien has put together for you. You have that whole imaginary Middle Earth. It ought to be just immensely rich and complex, yet it's, according to Juul, more under the control of the game designer who wants to make you go through it in a linear fashion than a game like chess where it's just a basic set of rules and an infinite variety of play. Yes.
Well, the difference between chess and like a role-playing game or something like that, the author has basically done the creative part for you. Whereas in chess, you really have to, I mean, it's a lot more interactive in a way. I mean, you can go through a whole role-playing game just sitting there and clicking one button.
true you can. But does that really seem true to you when you read a novel? That you're just, the author's done all the work for you, and so you don't have to. And when you're reading a good novel, isn't your imagination engaged and you find yourself being very creative in response to the creativity?
I'm not talking about necessarily a novel, but for example, Lord of the Rings, I mean, you see the imagined characters in front of you, whereas in chess, you can, you know, create your own moves, create how you're going to play the game.
Okay. Yes.
I don't think we would have English classes if authors wrote their books and put it out there in plain view for you, you know? Because, like, being able to interpret their writings is something that they want you to, you know, they want you to bring it up in discussion. Like, they put everything in there, you know, some of the more advanced novels don't put it, you know, right out there for you, and you have to decipher it.
Right. Yes.
I mean, just for example, about the novel point that you brought up, I mean, it'd be a lot more creative if instead of a novel, somebody gave you, like, almost like a haiku of just, like, three major plot points, and you could just fill in the rest for yourself. You know?
Okay, that's I'd like to see that. I mean, it'd have to be an awfully good haiku.
Or you'd have to have a very complex imagination.
That's right. Going back to Wark's point about the world, I moved over to Lexian 9. Wark's point about the world being a game, he means it in a very specific way. Look at this last sentence, last two sentences. It doesn't matter whether you think you are playing the bond market or Grand Theft Auto. It is all just an algorithm with enough unknowns to make a game of it. What does that mean? Make sense of that for me.
Sorry.
How is the bond market just an algorithm? You all, I mean, we've got half the economic and brains at Vanderbilt gathered into this room. You should be able to help me here. Yes, Daniel.
Well, I'm not exactly sure, but I was just saying that there really is no difference between what you're trying to do in the bond market and what you're trying to do in GTA. I mean, you're trying to obtain points or experience points either way. I mean, you have a goal and you're trying to get there, and either way, there's no difference.
That's a start.
Right.
But there's more to be said about this. Bond market as an algorithm. How is the bond market an algorithm?
Money,
but explain it though. I mean, spell that out. Make it explicit.
Well, I'm a pre-med. I'm not an econ, but.
Oh, gosh.
Here we go. I'll do my best. But basically, bonds are a way to get money, and like there's math and numbers and I don't know, I'm kind of losing my train of thought here, but
okay. Well, you have at least gotten us started here. What is a bond or a share of stock? Hmm. What kind of value is it? What kind of
liquid? No, not liquid. Sorry.
Best.
Yes. Were you going to answer? No. Other people? Yes, Professor?
Inherently, it has, I'm a former investment banker, I know a little bit about bonds. Inherently, it has no intrinsic value in and of itself.
Exactly.
It's a derivative product on a different reality. So if you have a bond, it is a promise from me to you that I will pay you this amount of money at a future date with this increased amount of interest associated with it. It's not a tangible good. It may be manifested on a piece of paper, but it's no more real than your +5 sword in Dungeons and Dragons.
Confidence. Good answer.
Got it? I mean, that's a powerful point that Wark wants you to think about. And further, it's not merely that you promise to repay it. That's only if someone keeps the bond. But the bond market is all about speculating on this intangible value.
And you think about the word bond, the bond between us.
I mean, but
I am so sorry to say your name is
Peter.
Peter has slipped out of my mind.
Well, whenever this in eighth grade, when my teacher brought out her Mrs. Brooks dollar, had her face on it, and she asked us how much it was worth, and we said it was nothing, and then she told us that dollars weren't worth anything. But I mean, the bond is worth something because we think it's worth something. And even if our entire room made a pact to say that dollars weren't worth anything, the entire world is, you can't make everyone believe that money isn't worth anything, because we've all agreed that money is worth things, so that I don't have to, you know, I don't have to go to some guy and work for him to get him to give me some butter. I can work for someone who can give me some money, and then I can go buy butter for it. It makes things more efficient.
Yes, Peter has just expanded this from bonds and stocks to the entire currency system. Money itself is nothing but an abstraction, a representation or a symbol of value. It is not value itself. So on that level, Wark wants you to understand that that our world is nothing but a world of shadows, that the shadows we play with we call currency in one world, and we call it hit points and XP in another world. While you're looking at your money, I'll go to the next link.
Where are you going? 10,
which is also part of Work's point about how the world is a video game. We only have 2 more minutes, so I want you to zero in on this. Once games required an actual place to play them, whether on the chessboard or the tennis court, even wars had battlefields, and fields is italicized. Warfare, they say, now looks like video games. Well, don't kid yourself. War is a video game for the military and entertainment complex. To them, it doesn't matter what happens on the ground. The ground, the old-fashioned battlefield itself, is just a necessary externality to the game.
Oh my, we should pull out Ender's Game for that one. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, right. We should be reading Ender's Game for that same point. You know that novel, Ender's Game, where the kids think they're playing a video game, and in fact, they're actually exterminating the alien civilization in its entirety. If you haven't read Ender's Game, I just ruined.
You gave it all away.
It's like it's sort of like another South Park episode I've seen when Kenny gets the PSP and he's fighting Satan.
Yeah, but that South Park is like Ender's Game, not Ender's Game's like South Park.
Yeah, that's the other direction. Yeah.
Right. So one left, 30 seconds left. So I mean, this is a bold contention, but if you remember Iraq War I in particular, probably you don't, but that was the first moment when we had the sense that this war was a video game, that people were sitting back with controllers guiding missiles into buildings, in through the window of buildings. I remember Colin Powell being so pumped about that, to see the missile go, you know, and you forgot that real human beings were there inside those buildings being disintegrated. That is another way in which he contends that reality has become, that the reality of games is stronger than the so-called material reality we think we live in. Stop there.
So what is our blog entry supposed to be about?
We know. The topic.
We'll post it to the Facebook and to the Oak.
And when is that to be done by?
When's it done by? Not
Friday.
Let's say Friday at 4 p.m.
No, that's not the same as the blog. Should we all get Jesper and read it? Are we going to need to talk about Warcraft Jesper?
And I'll be coming back to it when we get into the history of video games, doing some classifications. We've talked about simulation versus real-time strategy versus MMO.
So there's a paper due Thursday.
I know, but in what camp?
the
no, there's
the
not a paper due Thursday.
Oh,
the first blog is due Friday. It's not a paper, as I said. We're going to post it to every place we can think of. We'll put it in Oak, we'll put it in Facebook. We'll send you an email saying it's been posted. So,
the important thing, guys, is to get your blog account set up on WordPress.
And
I still need to join the guild.
Is just like
yeah, I need
to.
Okay.
Yeah, I need to.
You probably timed out.
I timed out.
Jay, I'm going to log back in real quick.